Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton and our producer, Katie Galley. Another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. And Stone, this is going to be a fun one.
Hey, this is going to be a fantastic show today. First up on Atlanta Business Radio this morning, we have with us the Dean for the College of Business and Mass Communication with Brunel University. Please join me in welcoming to the broadcast, PhD Suzanne Erickson. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Well, Suzanne, before we get too far into this, can you share a little bit about Brunel? What makes Brunel different?
Brunel is a very different place. Mm-hmm. We have our roots as a women's college. And so Brunel has been around since the 1800s, started as a women's college. And over the years, we've grown. And each of the four schools that make up Brunel are very different. I represent the College of Business and Mass Comm. And today, the women's college is about a third, slightly less than a third of the university. And so adult undergrads and graduate programs make up two-thirds of the university. In my college, the women's college makes up about 9%. And so the adult students are about 91%. So we're very much in the adult education business.
Now, where is Brunel located? Is there a home of Brunel,
official
Brunel College?
The main campus is in Gainesville, Georgia, an hour and 20 minutes north of here. We also have a campus in Jacksonville, one in Augusta, one in Fairburn, one in Norcross. And then for us, our biggest campus is online.
Is online?
Yes.
So then you have students from all over the world?
Exactly.
Wow.
Yes, we do.
So now, when did that transition occur?
Brunel has been very entrepreneurial over the years. And, you know, to stay alive, we've innovated. And so in the 70s, we were the first university to have evening adult part-time programs. And so we were kind of first...
In the country?
No, in the Atlanta area.
In the Atlanta area.
Yeah. So we were first to market with that. And our campus was in Norcross. Our main one was in Norcross. And then as we went through time in 2000, we started looking into online. And so it's a matter of convenience. Students vote with their feet. And so today, most of our students are choosing to be online.
Now, how does Brunel kind of differentiate themselves? If they're going to be online, now you're competing with every other online campus around the world, really, right?
That's true, but... A couple things are also true. Students tend to go to the campus nearest them.
Even online?
Yep.
And, really?
Yes.
Interesting.
And our president is sure of this next fact, that physical locations will lead to online enrollment. So since we opened the Jacksonville campus, we have a lot more Jacksonville area students online.
Even though they never stepped foot in the Jacksonville campus?
Yes.
Just the fact that they see it's part of the community...
Yes.
They want to become part of that.
Yeah. It's surprising because you're right. You know, you would think once you're online, I'm competing with everybody.
Right now, the world is flat. Right now, I can get people from all over the planet.
But, you know, maybe it's that when they're local, they know we're online and they don't know who else is. I don't know. Maybe they don't do enough research. you know, we have students, military students in Afghanistan and Hawaii and Korea and all over. So our reach is big. But the majority of our students are in Georgia.
So like that... The 80-20 rule applies in this case? Or like, is it about 80% of the students are kind of locally based?
Locally. Probably about that, yeah.
Wow, that's interesting. So now, how'd you get involved in the MBA program? Did you, you've been with it for a while?
Well, so I came to Brunel in 2007. I was hired as a department chair for the adult programs. And then I became associate dean, and then I became the dean of the whole college. This is my fourth year.
And was it always tied to Mass Comm?
Yes, it's always been the College of Business and Mass Comm. There again, Mass Comm is tiny and business is big. And it's because Mass Comm has, up until this year, remained only a women's college program.
Really?
And so in our college, we have about 900 students and Mass Comm is 22 of those. And so the vast majority, obviously, are business. But effective this year, we're starting Mass Comm programs online at the undergrad and graduate level. So I'm anticipating some big growth for MassCom as well.
Now, as part of the MassCom component, does that include journalism? Like, what is defined as MassCom?
Yeah, we have a radio station. So I've been interviewed on WBCX, cool. our radio station. But so we have journalism, television, radio, PR, are kind of all in MassCom. Mm-hmm. And one of the features of our MassCom program is that the students have to do practicums in all those things. So it doesn't matter what your concentration is, you will be doing radio time, you will be doing television time, you will be doing a journalism practicum and PR.
Oh, so you get a really well-rounded...
Exactly.
Now, are you going to add some component to tap into the social media push?
Like, yes, absolutely, that, yes.
Is that going to be a new pillar, or that's a subset
it's,
of...
It's a subset right now of what we're doing. A lot of the radio is obviously going to be in the affected with social media and also PR, for sure, right. and journalism, right. as a matter of fact. Yeah, so they all are.
So now, when a person is going through their MBA program, you mentioned a lot of them aren't ever stepping foot on the campus. How do you, as dean, kind of build a curriculum that can serve that constituency that never steps foot and also serve the people, some of which do step foot?
It's interesting. There's really no difference. We have the exact same curriculum, no matter if you're on ground or online.
That's what you call on ground?
On ground is if they come in person. Yes. That doesn't sound weird to me. So the MBA program is a 30-credit core, which is the standard stuff that all MBAs everywhere take, accounting, finance, marketing, management. And then you can tack on a 15-credit concentration in whatever you're interested in. And so the fact is that all of our students are going to end up online because we're a relatively small school, but we will never have 10 accounting majors in Jacksonville. And so to make the accounting, the marketing, the finance, all those majors available to all our students, they go online. Mm-hmm. And so we can get a critical mass online. So if you start your core courses on ground somewhere, you will end up online for your concentration courses. But so there is no difference. That we use a lot of... audio and video now in our online classes. So my students see me a couple times every week. and I see them. I have them do video introductions. So really, the distinction is kind of going away.
Now, what about from a training the educator standpoint? Is it a different skill to stand up in front of a classroom, interact with students like that, as opposed to, you know, in front of my webcam?
It's an absolutely different skill. You are much more of the facilitator. So the online student needs to be a disciplined, motivated student. I mean, I think that's maybe true on ground too, because just because you wander into a class and sit down for a 2-hour lecture doesn't mean you're retaining anything.
Right. But you can be on your phone
exactly.
multitasking just as much.
Exactly. But so online, we are the facilitators. And so a lot of the learning happens in what's called the discussion board, where I post questions and then my students post answers, and then they comment on each other. And so the discussion gets going in there. We have, I do lectures just like I would do in a normal class, and I give feedback. Technology is so great now. I teach finance. And so with the technology, I can go in and they can look at my face and I can say, this is what you did wrong on your homework. And then we can zoom in.
As an individual?
Well, I could do it as an individual. I do it for the whole group. Uh-huh. But then we zoom in on my Excel spreadsheet and I can click on the cells and say, you know, this is what you should have put here and this is how you do this. And so the technology is great now.
And it, after you get good at it, it's pretty seamless from you as the educator standpoint?
It is. It's very seamless, yes.
Now, you mentioned that a lot of your students are local. Are your professors local as well? Or in that case, do you tap into it and the world as your resource?
Well, we have our full-time faculty that are all in Gainesville, mm-hmm. pretty much. We have one in Fairburn, one in Augusta. But most of us are in Gainesville, and we're there normal business hours. And then we rely on a fairly large adjunct population, and mm-hmm. the adjuncts can be anywhere.
And then how do you recruit adjuncts?
We have a standing ad out there on our website, and people are always applying.
Is that really so people want to be...
They do. People... in biz, it's important that the adjuncts have business experience. Uh-huh. And so people reach a point in their career where they want to share what they've learned through the School of Hard Knocks. Right. And so a lot of people want to teach. A lot of people feel it's giving back. Mm-hmm. And so they're anxious to be adjuncts.
Is that an area where you need more of, or you got plenty at this point?
It depends on the discipline. The problem is, to teach in the MBA program, you have to have a PhD.
Uh-huh.
And so marketing is an area where we struggle to find adjuncts, because there's
marketers are not good at education.
Well, they don't go get PhDs. Right. That's not what they do.
If it was like I read 100 blogs, you know, maybe then I get a PhD. Then maybe it would be easier.
Yeah, that's right. So marketing, finance, economics, those are three areas we struggle. Management's pretty easy.
Mm-hmm. So now, for you, how do you know you've done a good job at the end of the day? What are you high-fiving people about?
We are continuously looking, evaluating what we do. And so we have student outcomes that we measure, and we measure them through standardized tests and through other measures that we do. We obviously look at our student evaluations. We look at our numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're constantly evaluating all of that. And as a private school, we have a lot of flexibility to change.
You can be nimble.
We are nimble. And so we are constantly looking at, are we offering the right degrees? And within those mm-hmm. degrees, are we offering the right skills?
Now, we've had some businesses in here over the years that talk about sometimes they partner with universities and create curriculum to serve an area of need for them. Do you have partnerships with business where you work together to create you know, so that the output for the student is almost a job?
No, we haven't done anything like that. The closest thing that we have to that is our partnership with the Oxford Center in mm-hmm. Atlanta. And it's the Oxford Center for Entrepreneurs. And we have a concentration in entrepreneurship in our MBA. And the students become members in the Oxford Center. And so that's really more for the benefit of the student than the Oxford Center. And it's a networking group. And
right.
so they attend functions down there and get to network with entrepreneurs and learn from them. And then they can choose to do an apprenticeship with somebody through the Oxford Center.
Now, what's the difference between an apprenticeship and an internship?
An apprenticeship is a paid for 6 months. And so it'd be more of like a full-time job, mm-hmm. whereas an internship would be part-time.
And then that
may or may not be paid.
But you can get course credit.
You can.
Uh-huh. Now, you guys have been the largest MBA program in the metro area for the last few years.
Right.
I don't know if everybody is aware of that.
Right.
How'd you pull that off?
Through online. It's totally online because, as you said earlier, your reach is much bigger with online.
Mm-hmm.
And so, partly probably because it's a part-time program, students stay longer because it takes maybe a little bit longer to get through if you're going part-time. But I attribute it mainly to the fact that we're online.
And you've been the largest program for how long?
4 years.
For 4 years
yeah,
running?
Right.
Wow.
Yeah.
And to go through the entire program, you mentioned was 30 credits and then another 15 for mm-hmm. a special. You have to go through to specialize?
You don't have to. We also offer the general MBA.
Uh-huh.
And so the general MBA is basically just the 30-credit core. And so I see those as two different target markets. So if you are working your way up the corporate ladder and you're in a field like take marketing, for example, and you've kind of hit a plateau because you need the MBA, but you don't need an MBA in marketing because you've been doing it for 20 years, the general MBA is perfect for you.
So that 30 credit, how long does a person typically take for that?
We have 7-week terms. So there's 2 terms in a semester.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could get through. So if you took 2 classes a time, you could get through in just over
a year. You're a math person. Which would be easy.
You can get through in just over a year.
So about a year, mm-hmm. you can get that 30-credit MBA.
Correctly.
And then maybe another semester is you're getting the other
15. It'd probably take 2 more. Well, a semester, yeah. Yeah.
Right. So that's 2 more 7-week periods.
Correct.
And then you can get the specialization. So a year, year and a half, you can get the full specialization if you wanted. But in a year about, you can get that MBA that could help you kind of
get
a raise, get a promotion.
And we also offer our concentrations as certificates. So,
If you want to do the inverse and just do the 15, you can get a specialization certificate in one of those kind of
correct.
Categories.
And then come back later if you want the MBA, or if you already have a master's in something else, or you know, a general MBA, you can come and get just the certificate.
So it sounds to me like you're pulling double duty, though. You're in the classroom, whether it's on the ground or online, and you're the dean. What's the distinction?
Well, I don't teach very much. I only teach three classes a year. And so I teach one class a semester.
That's three more than Lee teaches.
So last semester, I taught a women's college class, and those last the full semester. And I feel it's really important for me to teach in the women's college, because if I don't, I sort of forget they're there, because they're such a small part of what right. we do. And they're a big part of who Brunau is. And so it's really, really important to me to teach in the women's college. This semester, I'm teaching an MBA concentration class. And then in the summer, I'll teach entrepreneurial finance. So not much.
So now, for a student that's choosing an MBA program, what would you kind of sum up as Brunau's kind of secret sauce?
Well, the flexibility, number one. But the high quality, maybe that's number one. The high quality is number one, and the flexibility is number two. We have an amazing number of concentrations. We go back and forth with, are we crazy for doing this? But we're trying to give our students as many options as they can. And so we probably have more concentrations than anybody out there because we're always trying to expand the menu that the students can choose from.
What are some of the, you know, kind of out there ones?
So some new ones that we have that I'm really excited about are in business analytics and cybersecurity, but they're the management of. And so it's the management of business analytics and the management of cybersecurity. And so the five courses give them enough of each of those different topics that they can talk intelligently to the data scientists or the computer programmers. And so, but they're still the manager. And so it's big on the management skills, the management and the budgeting and all of that, but it gives them the language so that they can talk intelligently to the people doing the work. So those are two relatively new ones that I'm really excited about.
Well, I think you're on track, because I can't tell you how many people here are just saying
every
that
week.
I need a data scientist. That wasn't a thing a few years ago, and it is a big thing nowadays.
And then the cybersecurity people come in here and just scare the heck out of us every week.
Well, and the data scientists and the cybersecurity programmers, a lot of times those people don't have an interest in or an affinity for management. Mm-hmm. And so they're not necessarily the ones that are going to manage that group. And somebody was telling me last week that state and local government is prime for this, because people tend to move up in like city government in the planning arm and then find themselves in charge of these huge databases of confidential information.
Right. And they're in over their head.
Exactly.
And,
and so that's our target audience, people right. that need to be managing the people. So we're not training programmers, but we're right. training the managers of.
Right. And so that's very astute of you to be able to kind of move into that area so quickly. And that's an example of being private
being
and being nimble.
Exactly.
And so how do you kind of keep your finger on the pulse? How do you stay up to date like that?
Well, we're up in Gainesville, but I am on the Economic Development Council of the Chamber up there. And so listening to what they say, and then reading, you know, the Business Chronicle and the business periodicals. And I can't remember the source.
Listening to all the business radio X shows.
Yeah, around right. Obviously.
That's right.
That's a given.
But in analytics, what started this was an article. I can't remember the source of it, but there's going to be a mismatch of people to manage these analyst type people of like 20 million job openings in the next 10 years. And so just paying attention to what the press is saying out
right.
there.
And that must be rewarding from you of working in an institution like this, where you can say, hey, this is happening, and you get the go ahead to do it. It isn't like now 4 years later,
exactly.
you're, you know, some institutions having that thought and then having it actually executed to a program
and we, and
might
we
not
can
be
do
in your
that.
Lifetime.
We can do that in a year, which to businesses might sound like a long time, but in academics,
right?
A year
that's what
is,
I'm saying.
Yeah, is way faster.
I mean, I'm really impressed that you're able to do that, what you have right now, so quickly, because we're hearing about it now.
Right.
So well, good for you.
What a great way to make a living. So what's your favorite part? What do you like the best?
It is a great way to make a living. We had winter weekend this weekend where the high school students came, and one of the professors was talking to them about the difference between a job and a career. And if you can find what your passion is and make it your job, then you've got your career and it's happy, but it's making a difference in students' lives. A lot of our adult students are the first in their families to go to college, even the grads. And it's just so rewarding to think that you're helping them move up.
Right. And not only them, you're kind of showing that their whole family, this is possible. And then you're probably inspiring the next generation after them.
I could just tell a little story. So we had two students in our finance major, and one was in Gainesville and the other was in North Carolina. And for some reason, they paired up on group projects early on in the program. Mm-hmm. And so they stayed paired. And when they got to my class, they said, can we be a pair? And I said, sure. And at graduation, they met for the first time. Mm-hmm. And they commented that this is my best friend and we will be friends for life. Because, wow. But it had all been, you know, over the phone virtual. And over the computer. But they still made a really profound friendship.
And that's really an important distinction, because a lot of the people who may be apprehensive of getting an online education is the fear that they're missing out on those kind of relationships and the networking that takes place when you're in the same dorm or you're in the same fraternity and you're seeing these people day to day.
Right.
But if you can facilitate that type of relationship building, then you've really kind of cracked the code.
And in an online class, you can't remain silent. In an on-ground class, I don't always call on all my students.
Right.
But in an online class, you all have to participate. And I found that as especially powerful for international students, mm-hmm. Especially the Asian students, because in their culture, they wouldn't speak out in class, and they would never correct you if you did something wrong. But in an online class, I use the journaling function to get them to tell me what they're thinking and what's going on, and it draws everybody out.
And then is that part of the training when you're working with these adjunct professors, you're giving them kind of the tips and the tricks in order to kind of create this engagement?
Right. We have to go through, everybody before they teach online has to take two classes in how to do it. And then mm-hmm. we have annually refresher courses. And then part of the reason that I make the faculty come into school, even if they're teaching online, is that we learn a lot in the halls.
Right.
You know, hey, I tried this and this right. worked great. And so we
to get that continuous best practices
exactly.
in real time.
Yep.
All right. Where can our listeners go to learn more, to have a conversation with you or someone out there at the university?
They can go to brunau.edu and they will click on the College of Business and Mass Comm, mm-hmm. or they can click on whatever they want if they're interested in a different college. But yeah, brunau.edu.
And then the MBA candidate in your mind, who is that profile of the person who should consider getting an MBA from Brunau?
Good question. And I think you should have some work experience. And mm-hmm. so you said something before about the kids moving right from undergrad to grad, and I do not think that's a good idea. And mm-hmm. so the more work experience that you bring to the program, the more beneficial it's going to be to you.
And then, so this is the person, what, in their
30s?
In their 30s.
Mm-hmm.
They went to college, they have some experience, maybe they've plateaued, maybe they're frustrated, maybe they think they've gone in the wrong direction. That's a nice time to now consider an MBA program to kind of reboot.
It is, and one caveat to that, we have a healthcare concentration as well, and we see a lot of people going into that concentration that are trying to change careers.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say that you can't change a career with just a degree, that you have to have experience. And so, yeah, go ahead and get your MBA in healthcare, but you also need to try and get your foot in the door at whatever level in the healthcare organization to gain some experience.
But as part of the program, do you help in that regard in that you make these apprenticeships or internships, or you can kind of open the door for them to at least get their feet wet?
We do. We don't. Most of our adult students are working. Mm-hmm. And so most of them can't do internships.
Right.
We have an internship coordinator in the college, and she works with the women's college students and anybody else that needs it. But the way she works is you come to her and say, this is what I'm interested in. And then she goes through her contacts and finds one for you.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a very effective program.
Well, keep up the good work. And if there's anything at all that we can do to help facilitate a practicum or an internship, I mean, I think we'd be more than interested in trying to contribute to your effort. So keep that in mind. One more time, coordinates, best way for somebody to learn more.
Brunau.edu.
All right. Hey, how about staying with us? We got one more guest we're going to visit with.
I will.
All right. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, we have with us attorney and co-chair for the alcohol practice with the firm Taylor, Fowle, Harper, Lumsden, and Hess. And yes, we have the first guy in the list.
That's always important.
Please join me in welcoming to the show, Esquire. Is that the right word? Taylor, Harper. How are you, man?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
So what'd you learn in that last segment?
Well, I had no idea that you had such a big online presence. That's amazing. You know, I just started teaching beverage alcohol law class at Georgia State University. And some of what we're doing is, you know, via email and things like that. And I honestly, it's such a good option to have, because there's so many students that would like to take the class, but as you said, for convenience purposes, schedules conflict and they're not able to.
Well, Taylor, can you talk a little bit about how you decided to make your practice about the beverage and alcohol law?
Yeah, sure. It was more of the stars aligning than me making a conscious decision, really. When I started back in 2010, the firm...
Started lawyering?
Lawyering, yeah. Yeah, started life. Lawyering. The firm had been around since 78 in mm-hmm. various iterations, and it's a full-service firm, but has always had a heavy focus on hospitality and, in particular, beverage alcohol. And so when I got there, I was partial to the alcohol practice. There, it's got a little bit of everything.
It wasn't just like kind of personal hobbies or lifestyle.
That was certainly a part of it. Yeah, absolutely. Now that, you know, I'm a con law guy, and there's a lot of constitutional law in it, and I love that. There's a lot of policy in it, right? Alcohol is a heavily regulated substance. Right. And there's a lot of interaction on the local level because it's governed by three jurisdictions. So you got the feds governing it, the state governing it, and then municipalities and counties. And you really get to engage with, you know, in certain instances, residents, and get their views on how they feel about a brewery or a bar or distillery coming into their neighborhood. And you get to see how kind of the differences in their opinions, how some really want it and think that it'll contribute to the community and others are more fearful of it.
Now, who hires you typically? Is it the restaurant bar or the industry, you know, the growler industry hires
sure,
you, association?
Growler yeah. industry.
There's probably a growler association, I bet you.
Well, not really, but there could be. It's actually across the board. So I serve as general counsel to the Georgia Craft Brewers Guild. And that is how I really got kind of cemented into the beer industry. So mm-hmm. a lot of my clients are breweries. A lot of my clients are on that manufacturing tier. So breweries, distilleries, wineries.
They're all over the world?
No, most are, say, in the Southeast. Probably 80% are in Georgia. Mm-hmm. There are some on the other side of the U.S., but usually our representation of them is having their products come into Georgia or, you know, the Southeast, as opposed to representing them in California. Mm-hmm. And then we represent folks on the wholesale tier and the retail tier. So retail being bars and restaurants and hotels and growler shops and things like that.
So you help them, like say there's a... let's see, what, like a brewery or like a restaurant that sure. sells craft beer, you would kind of represent them to make sure that all of they're doing everything right?
Yeah, typically folks will come to us, we represent a lot of startups, and they'll come to us and we will help with forming the company, governance issues, you know, employee issues, and then certainly that regulatory component of, you know, alcohol licensing.
Right, because you can't screw this up. Like, there's a big penalty for getting this wrong, right?
Well, it certainly affects your timeline and when you get to open. And then mm-hmm. if you don't have that alcohol component, your business model is, you know, pretty much flopped, right? If your plan is to be a restaurant with a bar and you can't get an alcohol license, that's probably...
Oh, so you help restaurants get that? Because that, I mean, I can't tell you how many restaurants we've had in here just like, oh, we were supposed to start here.
Oh, yeah.
And then it's like a year later
right,
sometimes.
Right, yeah.
That's real, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. If you don't know where the snakes in the grass are, you can get bit and it can really affect your timeline pretty significantly.
So now when you're working with them, so it's good for you to know them at the beginning so you can help them get their ducks in a row before they make a mistake or...
Yeah, it's much less costly to handle things on the front end, right, than it is
right after you've already got a lease
messed up. Yeah, right, right,
right. That's
that happens a lot. Folks will, you know, for instance, and give you an example. There's distance requirements. So certain establishments have to be a certain number of feet away from schools and churches and things like that. And sometimes folks will come to us after they've executed a lease and having not known about distance requirements. And it's like, ouch. Oh, wow. Really?
So then the strip center may not have given them the heads up.
Well, and a lot of times the strip center just isn't aware.
Uh-huh.
Right.
So you got to be the first stop, though. Because, I mean, the first person you want to talk to is Taylor.
I would agree with that.
Right? I know that's self-serving, but I mean, seriously, just logically, you that's step one if you're going to have alcohol involved at all, because you can help think through, okay, where to locate and everything.
Right. Yeah. Folks come to us and we kind of give them the timeline of things that they need to consider, how long it's going to take. And usually when they leave our office after a consultation, they're pretty satisfied and think it was worth the value, because they go, gosh, I didn't know about those 10 different things. And those are really big factors into how we're going to go about this.
Now, how has the craft brewing industry changed? That it seems to be kind of a fairly recent development in some areas. Like growlers, I mentioned that earlier. Mm. Now I'm seeing growler stores. You know, maybe 10 years ago, I don't remember seeing growler stores.
Yeah, technically growlers weren't allowed 10 years ago. It was probably 6 or 7 years ago that there was an interpretation by the Department of Revenue that allowed for growlers.
Like, but what's a growler?
It's a container. You know, typically people think of it as a glass container, and you take that container into an establishment and they will fill it with fresh beer from a keg and they will seal it, and you take that container home.
Mm-hmm.
And you can reuse it. Now you're seeing things that you might hear this term, crowlers. So it's a can instead of a glass growler, right? And it's sealed in the same way a regular can would be. So it can preserve the contents longer.
But this is now a new type of business. Like
over the last 6 or 7 years, you've had growler shops pop up in every single neighborhood.
And it's not a bar. It's somebody that you can go in there, fill your container with a craft beer that's kind of local and unique, right?
I've never done this. This sounds cool.
It depends.
I'm going to get a list from you after the show.
Sure. It depends on where you are. Certain local jurisdictions are a little more flexible than others. And so certain growler shops, you're right, you can only go in and fill your growler and leave. And other ones, you can go in and you can sample product. Because if you're going to buy a 64-ounce growler of some new product, you probably want to try it first, right?
And then once you open the door to trying it, now you can I get a small?
You can.
That's the size of a glass.
Well, no, it's like Napa Valley. This is great. So you could go in, taste just like you're in Napa Valley on at a wine tasting.
You can. Here, and the distinction is, right, that growler shops, they don't make any beer. They just sell other manufacturers' beer, right?
That's a distinction.
Right.
Growler so they're shops, not a brewery.
They are not breweries. They are selling the products of breweries. And breweries now, so you might, I don't know if you recall, if you've been to a brewery in Georgia, you know, let's say 5 years ago, you would go in and they would sell you a souvenir glass. So you'd go to Sweetwater, right? And they would sell you a souvenir glass for $10 and then take you on a tour and you would get a limited amount of beer to try.
Right.
Interestingly, every brewery was supposed to have a sign up that said, you can bring your own cup. So if you had that red Solo cup in your car, you didn't have to pay the $10.
And it'd be free?
Walk in and free. And the brewery had to serve you. That's kind of crazy when you think about it.
That was on the down low. They didn't want that to be known.
Like, you don't have to buy the product to enter the sweepstakes. It's kind of along that same line. Right,
right. And so fast forward about 2 years to, 2015, the Georgia Craft Brewers Guild and stakeholders in the industry tried to pass what we call direct-to-consumer sales, so that you could walk in a brewery and they'd be allowed to sell you beer to consume on the premises and a limited amount to take home with you. Well, that didn't work out exactly as we had all planned, and we got this kind of weird scheme where the brewery could sell you a tour for a certain price, and then you got free beer to try on the premises and a free souvenir to go, which was a six-pack or a growler to go. But it was not a sale of alcohol, right?
That would be ridiculous.
It was confusing to everybody.
So for that, could you be of any age?
Oh, no.
No, you still had to be over 21
Absolutely.
Or 18 or whatever.
Absolutely.
To get your souvenir.
Right, right. And then this past year, we were successful. The Georgia Craft Brewers Guild and stakeholders and the wholesalers all came to the same table, and retail sales were passed. So now you can walk into a brewery and you can consume, you can basically consume as much as they'll sell you within liquor liability law. And you can take up to 288 ounces, which is a case of beer, per person per day to go. That way, if you go visit, you know, particularly if someone from out of state or out of town, they come to Sweetwater, they come to Red Brick or something like that. They take a case home. They, you know, all their friends have it and they like it. And then it builds that brand. It's interesting. What we're seeing is, you know, before breweries had to rely on one revenue stream, and that was distribution. They have to get product to their wholesaler that sells it to the retailers, the bars, restaurants, grocery stores, what have you. Now that they can rely on retail sales, what I'm seeing is the business model has shifted drastically. Before, where you had to try to be a regional brewery because you, you know, you had to produce 5,000, 6,000 barrels to get into the black. Now that's not the case. You can produce 500 barrels, 1,000 barrels, and be operating profitably. And so the business model has shifted from a regional brewery to let's be the neighborhood brewery.
Wow. That's a game changer.
It really is.
Now, are you allowed to distribute the beer in this case across state lines? Like, can I, like I try, you know, my buddy goes and
he
gets
buys everything on Amazon. What he's getting at. He wants to go on Amazon and order Red Brick.
Because look, I get the case just like you described. I go back to my house in North Carolina. They don't have this here. People are like, I love this. Can they ship me this now?
So no, there are only very few states, about eight in the country, that allow for shipping of beer. So could, you know, Red Brick ship to a state that allows it? Yes, if they got the proper licensing in that state. If somebody comes to Red Brick, can they take it back to their home state? That depends on what the home state's, you know, personal importation laws are, which almost every state in the country has some sort of allowance for you to be able to bring back product.
Like, okay, I got to ask why. Why can't you just ship the stuff like a can of carton of shirts?
It's on its way there. You know, you can do it with wine in almost every state, and actually in every state in the country. I think it's heading that way towards beer, but you know, alcohol has a very, very troubled past, right? In the United States. And it's just going to take a long time. Everything's with baby steps when it comes to alcohol.
What's going
to
come first, cannabis or liquor?
Or a beer, you know, that I can get from Alabama.
What's interesting, right? So the spirits, distilled spirits, right, are trying now to make arguments that they should be able to ship, direct ship in the same way that wine is. And if, you know, that's an honest question about the cannabis versus distilled spirits. And I think probably, you know, cannabis makes more headway before they're going to allow direct shipping.
I'll tell you, it's lighter
and
easier to ship.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Right.
So now your area of practice is beverage alcohol law. Is beverage also include non-alcohol?
It does.
So what do you do in that regard?
It's a lot of the same types of, you know, functions. We help with forming companies, employment issues, litigation. There's still regulatory compliance and hurdles there. Obviously, contractual arrangements with wholesalers and other outlets where they're selling their products.
So now, are you bullish for this Georgia brewery? Is that an area that you think there's going to be more of? Are we now at the kind of
absolutely
tipping point?
Absolutely. I think people used to ask, do you think that Georgia is nearing, you know, saturation?
And I think it's the opposite.
Absolutely. You know, if the law hadn't changed, I would say that Atlanta was getting close to saturation because you were only relying on distribution. Mm-hmm. Georgia still wasn't anywhere close, even if the law hadn't changed. But now that the law has changed, it's wide open. I can give you an example of a few weeks ago, we held a Dreamers workshop where we kind of do it's an illegal accounting and a business banking 101 for folks who want to start craft manufacturers.
Oh, like dreaming of being in this industry?
Correct. Yeah, right. And there were 92 breweries in planning. These are folks with legitimate business plans, seeking financing.
But they're not pros. These are people with dreams of doing this. Maybe they're accountants during the day. But
well, we should have our own beer. Don't you think? Business Radio X?
I just wanted our own coffee. I want our own coffee. I was aiming for that. But so is that a thing? Private label beer?
It is. It's a little bit complicated, but it can be done.
It can be done. When a lawyer says it can be done and kind of winks at me.
Right.
Earlier in the conversation, I think you used the term liquor liability or something. You said within liquor liability. So
sure.
That's something you got to watch out for too. If you're running a restaurant or so, I don't know anything about it, but there's some rules about what, how much you can serve or being aware of if Lee's getting a little tipsy. And
right. You're not supposed to knowingly serve someone who's intoxicated and you have some sort of, you know, reasonable suspicion that they're going to go drive afterwards. Mm-hmm. That can be liable for any acts that occur after that. And typically it's actually the person serving the product. So the bartender. But if you get in an accident and hurt somebody, and they go hire a lawyer.
Everybody's got the money. Yeah.
Now, what about when they're, because now isn't there a brewery on the Beltline?
There's several.
Right. So now they're on the Beltline. That's a walking.
Right.
So do they have less liability in some regards because people have to walk there to get there?
No, I mean, you're still going to get the same level of liquor liability insurance. You know, certainly if the risk may be a little bit less or the likelihood of some occurrence may be less because more people are walking as opposed to driving, but it only takes that one person, right? Mm-hmm. So you're still going to have to get covered to the same degree.
Now, is there any legislation that's happening now that we should be aware of in this area?
Well, there's a couple of things haven't been dropped yet, but you remember maybe last year the bill called the Brunch Bill.
Everybody, brunch?
It's called the Brunch Bill, right?
So, she knows it.
So right now on Sundays, you cannot go to a restaurant and get alcohol until 12:30. It's a state law.
But you can buy alcohol like at the grocery store?
Not until 12:30. So if people want to go to brunch on Sundays, right?
Right.
And you want to get a mimosa or you want to get a Bloody Mary and you can't. You got to wait till 12:30. So now there has been a bill for the past couple of years that's tried to go through to allow restaurants to be able to serve alcohol starting at 10:30 if your local jurisdiction will allow it. And so I think this year is going to be the year that
10:30
that it gets passed. 10:30.
And now in some states or municipalities, is it you can buy alcohol at any time?
Yes.
So we're not leading the front in this area.
Not at all.
I just know that we must do our grocery shopping and beer shopping and all that not on Sunday morning because. If I go to the Publix Sunday morning, I can't buy beer, wine, whatever?
Correct.
Monday morning, I can.
As soon as they open, 6 a.m., you go in there and buy some.
So Monday morning, I can get a beer at 6 a.m.
If you want.
Tuesday morning, 6 a.m.
Yep.
Just not Sunday.
Every morning except Sunday morning.
Correct.
From 6 till noon.
Right.
That is... yeah, please.
I was just going to say, I'm originally from Washington, and you ask our... Washington State. And so the whole... you won't be surprised to know that on the whole West Coast, it's okay to buy alcohol anytime.
Right.
But so when we first moved to Georgia, I had the hardest time with that because sometimes I do my grocery shopping, you know, Sunday morning, right. And you go up to the checkout counter with your bottle of wine or your six-pack of beer, and you feel like a criminal.
Right.
And they turn you away.
And they say no.
Yeah, yeah.
With a crazy look in their eye.
Exactly.
And they're mad at you because now they got to restock them. So now, so that's slowly changing an hour at a time. So maybe in 10 years from now, it'll be 24/7.
Like I said, baby steps. Yeah.
So you must have a lot of patience to be in this industry. And a lot, you got to kind of manage the expectations because time is slower for you in a lot of areas, right?
In some ways, yeah, absolutely. And it can be frustrating. You know, you have to anticipate the needs of business owners and their frustrations. And certainly all the legal hurdles that they have to jump through can be very frustrating.
Because like you take a chain from California and then comes here to Atlanta and thinks the rules are going to be similar. And especially in California, they're restrictive in so many other areas.
Yeah.
Right, where you get into this area, you think this is a no-brainer, and then all of a sudden you're like, whoa, pop the brakes here. That's not going to work.
You know, for instance, in some states, you can have as many liquor stores as you want. In other states, there's a cap of, say, 10.
As an individual or my company?
Your individual or company. If you come to Georgia, you can have two.
Two per person?
Two liquor stores.
So my company or because I have two or my wife can have two?
No, it's within, listen to this. This is the law, right? Wow. Within the first degree of consanguinity or affinity, according to canon law. That's what the law on the book says right now. That's how old school it is.
And when was this law started?
Oh, goodness gracious.
Now, it could be like 1800.
No. It would have been after Prohibition.
After Prohibition.
After the repeal.
So what's that? That was in the...
1933 it was repealed.
After the first version of Prohibition. And from what this conversation, I think we still have a version of Prohibition in effect here. So, I mean, do you have to sell? Business must just be... Your phone must be ringing off the hook. You don't have to.
No one could do this by themselves. You need a Sherpa.
You're not out there marketing this, right?
It's interesting. I was for a while.
Yeah.
And I had a blog, the Georgia Craft Beer Lawyer blog, and I did all this stuff, right, for PR and marketing, and it worked. And now I don't have time to do it because the phone is ringing.
Right, because it's impossible for a person, a business owner that's good at making burgers, to do this too.
It would be a huge headache, and they would run into
issues.
And the
learning curve is impossible.
But we could sell Bull peanuts and give away beer with every bag, maybe. Well, we'll consult you on that.
You probably can't.
Maybe not. Maybe talk to Taylor first, right?
It'd be a good idea.
Now, you mentioned that you're also teaching a class. How'd that come about?
I had presented at a few different conferences and a symposium and continuing legal education seminars, and I really enjoyed it. And I've always had I went to Georgia State University both for undergrad and for law school, and I have a kind of interesting story with GSU. My mother, who's also an attorney, went back to law school when I was 9, I guess that had been 89. And there were times in the afternoon classes where she couldn't find a sitter for me. So she'd bring me to GSU and I would sit in her law classes. And what's cool is some of those same professors I had 15 years later when I took those classes.
And you've already been sitting in their class.
Right.
So you should get some credit.
and now I wish, right? And now here I am teaching
it side by side.
Yeah.
Wow. That's an amazing story. So now, if somebody wants to learn more, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
www.tfhlegal.com. And I may say, the firm name is quite a mouthful, right? Taylor File, Harper, Lumsden, and Hess. So I always just refer to it as TFH.
TFH. And I got it wrong in the beginning, right? I said you're the first in the list. Taylor's your first name.
Yeah,
that's a last name.
That's
right
confusing
there.
Too, right?
Right. Well, maybe.
You're not even on the list.
Harper.
Oh,
you're the H.
And there's two Harpers.
One of the H's.
You're third on the list. Okay. So you are in the list.
Well, he can take credit first,
Yeah, why don't you start off with Harper?
I'll just take all of it.
All right. So one more time, the website?
www.tfhlegal.com.
And then you're available to speak. So if there's conferences out there and they need a speaker in this, you've done this, been there, done that.
Absolutely.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for being part of the show. It was great.
Thanks for having me.
All right. And thanks to you, Dr. Suzanne, and telling us all about Bernal.
Thank you for having me as well.
All right, this is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton and our producer, Katie Galley. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.